Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Hey, this is the Shame Free Zone. Thanks for tuning in to our new time, Saturdays at 2 p.m. Pacific Time. I'm kind of enjoying this new time slot. I'm actually still wide awake. We were doing evenings, which is also nice, but and I'm kind of a night owl. But I don't know. I'm run different energy on Saturdays, so it works. Anyway, got an interesting topic today. If you're following me on Twitter, then you know already that we're going to be talking about how to have a happy divorce. Now, that sounds a little odd, maybe even like an oxymoron, doesn't it? How could you possibly have a happy divorce? I'm not an expert on that, but we're going to find out because my guest today is Jim Duzak, the attorney at Love. Hey, I got oxymorons coming out of the woodwork here. An attorney at Love. Who ever heard of such a thing? So let me tell you a little bit about him. He's a divorce lawyer. That sounds kind of ominous, huh? And a mediator. A little more hopeful there. A relationship columnist, a former dating service owner, and the author of the book, Midlife Divorce and the Rebirth of Commitment. Until recently, he was the host of the Relationship Radio Show on Voice America Network, and he's a graduate of Boston College Law School and a member of the Massachusetts Bar. So I have a feeling that Jim Duzak is going to give us a whole new spin on what it means to be a divorce lawyer. I think that's kind of something that's gotten a bad name. But anyway, Jim, welcome to the Shame Free Zone.
Well, thank you very much, Veronica. And maybe I probably never should have used the term with you, how to have a happy divorce, because obviously divorce is, for most people, not really a happy event. It's the death of a dream, among other things. But maybe we should call it how not to have an ugly divorce.
Well,
might be a little closer to reality.
I say set your sights high. But you know what? I understand from looking over your writings, which, you know, you write quite a bit on this topic.
Mm-hmm.
You actually estimate that about 80% of the divorces that take place are unnecessary.
That's what I truly believe. My feeling is that unless you have the kind of marriage that's characterized by physical or emotional abuse or repeated infidelities or perhaps untreated alcoholism or drug abuse, most of the time, if people care enough about preserving it, which is a big if in some cases, but that those marriages not only can be saved, but they can be enhanced to the point where both the husband and the wife are living quite happily together. I really do believe that. I think most of the time people get divorced because they don't know how to resolve their problems. You know, they get these issues that just keep, it's the same ones over and over again, and they constantly are up against a brick wall. You know, one person, or they don't know how to discuss those issues, you know, without one person having a total meltdown and the other person just withdrawing into a shell. I mean,
you
that's
know,
the way it is in so many relationships.
Well, you're talking my language now, Jim, you know, because I teach something called relationship repair, and that is actually part of my advertising. I go, are you tired of having the same fight over and over again? And I think that's
exactly
what most couples do, is they get, it becomes a broken record, and pretty soon they've really got a choice. Either they're just going to be in constant conflict, or they're just going to stop communicating altogether.
Right, and basically people are living in the past all the time. And, of course, the reason they live in the past is that things weren't resolved in the past. So you get all the time. I mean, how many times have we, and I've said this myself, you know, I mean, I hate to admit this, but, you know, where we say something to our husband or wife, where we start with the words, you never or you always. You know,
yeah.
You never listen to me. You always put your needs first, you know, that kind of thing. And
right.
Where does that go? You know, the other person says, what do you mean? you're the one who never, or you're the one who always does this. And,
exactly.
And they don't even know what it is they're arguing about. You know,
these are not even adult conversations, are they? This is really kind of back to the grade school sandbox.
It's really true, and yet
no,
that's the reality
no,
for a lot
Johnny
of people.
Started it. He hit me first.
Well, you know, it does seem laughable when you're not going through it, you know,
right.
And you know, but it's very real for these people, and I say these people, and I mean it really. As I say, I'm as guilty of some of this as anyone is. It's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. You know, I mean, I've made a lot of mistakes myself in all the years I've been married, and I've been married twice too. So I know that mistakes can be fatal to a marriage. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book is not so much to tell my life story, because that's not what I do, but really to try to give other people a perspective on marriage and to encourage them not to give up too easily or too quickly, but on the other hand, not to stay forever in a hopeless situation. Because, you know, those are the two extremes that you often see. Now, the people who stay forever in a hopeless situation are not the kinds of people who, by, you know, a divorce lawyer is normally not going to see those people. But I know plenty of people as friends or even people that I'm related to who have been putting up for years with sometimes the most ridiculous situations, you know, and they seem to think that, you know, they're living in a world where there are no options. You know,
I think is really interesting about this, Jim, too, is that it's usually the people who are not having violence and chemical dependency and alcoholism in their relationships that are probably going to be more likely to get a divorce or to seek couples counseling or something like that, because their tolerance for abuse or discomfort or unhappiness is very low. And when you look at the personality types of the people who actually will put up with alcoholism, drug addiction, domestic violence, a partner who is just perhaps psychologically and verbally abusive, those people are usually kind of coming from dysfunctional homes where they've gotten quite acclimated to that kind of behavior. And they have a high tolerance for it, and they're actually the people who need most to move away from that and are least likely to do so.
Least likely, right. They're living out their lives really in a type of victimhood, you know, and it's really sad because, you know, we've heard the expression actions have consequences, but so do inactions, you know? I mean, I'd hate to be the kind of person who wakes up and feels that he or she has wasted the only life they'll ever have on this earth.
Oh, God, no. My parents made the mistake of staying together, and it was so funny. When I was 8 years old and my sister was 6 years old, they took us aside and said, and this just, the way they couched this question, the fact that they even posed it to us, will tell you a lot about how dysfunctional their relationship was. But they said, "So, what do you girls think? Do you think we should get a divorce?"
Yeah, that's a total abdication of adult responsibility.
Well, they were not adults. That was the whole problem. But what's kind of comical about it is that we both said in unison, without giving it a second thought, "Yes, please."
Because did they in fact get divorced?
Oh, God, no, they were both horrified. They circled the wagons against us kids. It was like, oh, we're in love. Huzzah!
Well, that goes to show that you should never ask a question if you can't handle the answer.
Oh, well, yeah. They had, you know, they're old school. They had this expectation that the kids were going to say, oh, no, please, Mommy and Daddy, don't get a divorce. But, you know, it was 1968. In 1968,
yeah.
I was 8 years old, and I guess the new consciousness around expectations that people had for relationships had infused me, even though I was only 8 years old. It was kind of like, why are you guys together? You're so miserable, and you're making everybody else so miserable. But
well, you know, and that raises, yeah. I was going to say
that. Well, it was a really dysfunctional relationship, so. It fits your category of all the reasons you'd want to get out of a marriage.
Right. And, you know, in terms of the kids, I mean, I agree with you that parents should never ask their kids to be the decision makers and this type of thing. But you know, so many people do still stay together, quote unquote, for the sake of the kids. And my personal opinion, and I'm not a child psychologist, but I do believe that even though divorce is tough on kids, there's no question about that, but it's also tough to be, let's say, to live in a home like the kind of home you were in and obviously be exposed to that. Or even if the parents do a good job of hiding it, so what do they do then? So they wait till the kids are 18 and then say to them, you know, your mom and I have not gotten along for a long time and we're going to be, you know, filing for divorce. And the kid feels that this so-called happy childhood was a big fraud.
Absolutely.
You know, what good is that?
And not only that, but what you're modeling, because children don't pay attention to what you say. They're watching what you do. And and they're not stupid. They can pick up on body language that says we're miserable and hate each other, you know. And
right.
And they can also pick up on body language that says, as I'm frustrated, I wish I wasn't here. And if the message that you're giving your children is that you should suffer all kinds of indignities for the sake of the children, then you're pretty well dooming them to live that life too. You know, if they'll likely get into a relationship that's unfulfilling or perhaps abusive, and they're going to stay because that's what their parents did.
And then also the guilt that the child must feel afterwards when, you know, the parent says, I put up with all of that for you.
I've heard that one.
Yeah.
You know, and all I feel like saying is that you shouldn't have. You know, thanks so much for the thought, but you shouldn't have. That's like maybe the worst gift I ever got.
Well, when people, you know, talking about, you were saying before about how your kids in the playground or whatever, it's almost like that line that, you know, kids would say, look what you made me do. You know, you're trying to absolve yourself of all responsibility for something. I did it because of you. You know, I suffered because of you. I did it so that you kids could grow up in a two-parent home and all that. And I'm all in favor of two-parent homes, believe me, but only if they're reasonably functional.
Yeah. And usually when a relationship is incredibly dysfunctional like that, it's not even the truth. The parents are so self-absorbed and narcissistic that they've not done anything for their kids or for their kids' sake. They stay in the relationship because they're afraid of life on their own, or, you know, they lack the courage to create any kind of conflict in their relationship and seek help that might be able to resolve that conflict. So, you know, they're the kind of people who like to bury their heads in the sand.
That's right. The kids become a convenient excuse. You know,
right.
I'm just staying there for them. You know, but the truth is they can't handle the unknown or they can't make decisions or whatever it may be.
Exactly. In my mother's case, she wanted desperately not to to be like her mother. She was having a reaction against her mother. She saw her mother as being kind of a troublemaker, and she was like, I'm going to just do everything my husband tells me to do, and I'm going to be the perfect Christian wife, and everything will be wonderful, and we'll all go to heaven. And divorce for her was some big sin she didn't want to commit. Now, you must have, in all your mediation, you must have run into at least a few people out there who had some deep belief that either divorce was a personal failing or a moral crisis.
Oh, yeah. You know, and just so you understand, I want to make sure that your listeners understand that mediation is not the same as marriage counseling. A mediator is not necessarily trying to get people back together, although, you know, the funny thing was the mediation process can sometimes, because it's the first time in a long time where the people may actually be sitting and talking to each other in a normal tone of voice with the help of some third person in the room, and they're making decisions in a helpful way and so forth, that it actually can bring people back together. And sometimes people do say, well, let's give it a try again. But the whole idea of mediation is that you're trying to get them to make decisions regarding their divorce. In other words, the assumption is that they've already made a decision to get divorced, and the mediation becomes what's going to happen with our property and the kids and the pension plans and whether there's going to be alimony and how much child support is going to be paid. It's basically taking those decisions out of the hands of the judge and putting them back into the hands of the husband and wife. And that's what that's really what divorce mediation is. It's trying to get people to be, basically to create their own destiny. You know, I actually shouldn't have said child support there, because in most states, in every state actually now, child support is governed by these child support guidelines that are part of the state statutes. So if the husband and wife decided that no, there's not going to be any child support, a judge would probably overrule that as not being in the best interest of the kids. But in almost every other example I could come up with, a judge will normally go along with what the parties decide in mediation, as long as it was clear that one person wasn't intimidating the other person or pulling the wool over her eyes or, you know, hiding assets and, you know, things like that. It's really one of the, you know, we start out by saying, you know, a happy divorce, and I said, well, maybe a less ugly divorce. And mediation really is one of the devices, let's say, that's available to people who get divorced to really to get through the whole divorce process with dignity and without poisoning the waters for the future, and also without totally bankrupting them. Because I use mediation as an alternative to what you might call a litigated divorce. You know, a litigated divorce is where each person has their own lawyer and they're basically fighting each other over every issue, you know. And if they can't resolve it, they let the judge decide. But that's a very inefficient and expensive way of making decisions. You know, I mean, you're paying you could be arguing over the cups and saucers in your kitchen cabinets, you know, and you're each paying some lawyer $200 an hour to argue over these things. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, it really is crazy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, no, I get that. Mediation is really for once you have decided you are going forward with the divorce.
Right.
It's
not the same as marriage
counseling. So, well, that would certainly lead to a happier divorce now, wouldn't it?
Well, it really would, because if you get into this habit of agreement, and again, the mediator's job is to be listening to the people and to try to offer suggestions, you know, that may work, and then if the first suggestion doesn't work, you try another one, and you keep talking and you keep them talking until you can put something together. And the beauty of it is, I mentioned that the people can control their own destiny, but getting into the habit of agreeing during the divorce process can make life a lot easier after divorce, especially if there are kids. Because if there are kids involved, you know, you can get divorced when, you know, the child is 1 year old, but you're going to be a part of each other's lives at least until the child comes of age, and realistically until the day you die. Because when your child is old enough and the child has children of her own, or when your parents die and there's a funeral to attend and, you know, and all of that, you don't want to have poisoned the water so much that you and your ex-wife or ex-husband can't even be in the same room again. You know?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, like 2 years ago, my former stepson, I mean, I'm not married to his father anymore, so technically he's not my stepson, but I've been in his life since he was 8 years old. He's 32 now. He was getting married in Maui, and of course I was invited as if I were still a family member. So I went, and I mean, you know, there's his mother, who has been in my life since I was 21 and first met his father in 1981. I mean, it's silly in some way. You may think you're going to get away from the stuff, but you won't. At some point, there's going to be grandkids or a marriage or
absolutely
a funeral. Something.
Really, until the day you die. Until the day you die, and even if there are no children involved, most people are not necessarily going to get divorced and then move halfway across the country. I mean, sometimes they do, and sometimes they live in a big city where their paths will never cross again. But in the majority of cases, they're still the same social circles, or the two people may even work in the same company, or you know, live in the same neighborhood, and you don't want to have the kind of thing where you have to cross the street when you see that person again. You know, again, you don't have to be best friends, but you should be able to be at least adult about it, and again, mediation, because it promotes the kind, not just agreements per se, but all of the little accommodations that go into making an agreement, you know, in other words, the compromises, you know, and unfortunately, as I say, sometimes, you know, in most cases, it probably comes a little too late to help save the marriage. But in some cases, as I say, people, for the first time or the first time in a long time, are actually behaving civilly to each other. Maybe it's the presence of the mediator, you know, the third person in the room that helps, you know, where they're not going to be as nasty to each other with someone else listening. I don't know, but oftentimes they can get down to business on things and realize that, you know, a difference of opinion does not have to mean a yelling and screaming match.
One of the things I'm going to quote you here, you say, for many people, conflict means one person having a meltdown and the other person retreating into a shell. It doesn't have to be that way. And then you advise
really
people in troubled relationships and marriages start with themselves to define who they really are and then decide if they can live the kind of life they were meant to live, what you call an authentic life, in their current marriage. Do you want to talk about that a little bit more?
Well, I spent so many years dealing with divorces and feeling that, sometimes the divorce lawyer, unless there's, a lot of litigation going on in the case where you're having these pretrial motions before the judge and all of that, and you're appearing in court all the time with the husband and wife together. A lot of times you actually don't see the other spouse. You don't meet the other spouse until the court date. You know, when it's actually all over. Like you represent the husband, and you keep hearing about this awful wife that he has. You know, all this stuff. And then you see the person, and I used to feel all the time that these people are ideal for each other, you know, and they're probably never going to find anyone else who's any better, you know. And I'm not necessarily saying that they should have to stay together forever, but I was convinced that people were just giving up, in many cases, giving up way too early on things. So I, over the years, I used to do workshops sort of as a sideline to my law practice, where I would do workshops on how to avoid divorce. You know, and talk about how to get over some of the problems in your marriage. And as you said, quoting something that I wrote before, that I think the key is to figure out, is to start with who you really are. And because if you're not living a life that's reasonably close to your own values, a life that I call an authentic life. I'll define that in a second. But if you're not living this authentic life, everything in your marriage is just going to be, you're going to be pushing that rock up the hill, so to speak. You know, everything is going to be an uphill battle. You know, and what I mean by an authentic life is a life in which your long-term values are in reasonable harmony with your everyday actions. you know, there's always going to be days where you're not able to live the kind of life you want to live. You know, we get all kinds of things that come up in our lives. But in general, over the long term, if your values are in harmony with the kind of life you're living, that's what I mean by an authentic life. An authentic life for you, Veronica, may be a different from an authentic life for me. You know, we might have different values, you know, certain things that...
I have a hunch that could be true, but I don't know.
Yeah, well, but basically it's a life that defines rather than disguises who you really are. You know, I like to use the image of masks, you know. In other words, most of us in our lives, we wear different masks depending on the activities that we're involved in. In other words, if I'm being interviewed for somebody on a radio show, let's say, I hate to see it this way, but in a way, I'm wearing a certain mask. You know, there's a certain persona probably that I'm trying to put forth, and it may be a different persona than if I'm at the Safeway supermarket chatting with the cashier. You know what I mean?
I actually prefer to look at these as different facets of ourselves, which is one of the reasons I encourage couples not to just experience themselves through their partner, because you are a different person at work as opposed to a different person at the playground, as opposed to a different person at college, as opposed to a different person at all women's gathering or an all men's gathering,
right,
as opposed to the person who goes to Las Vegas.
You
have so many different facets of yourself, and really it's exciting and wonderful to be in a lot of different situations with a lot of different people because you get to meet all these sides of yourself.
Well, you're right that can be really fun, but if one of those facets of, if it's not so much a facet of your personality, but you're playing a role that you don't really want to play, you know, let's say you're in a role that's being defined by your spouse, you know, you have a husband or a wife who wants you to be X, Y, or Z, you know. You know what I mean? And like you write a lot and talk a lot about sex and sexuality. You know, if you're in a, and I'm just making this up as an example, there could be a million examples, but if you're a woman, let's say, who's in a marriage with a guy who is constantly pressuring her to go to swingers parties or to get involved in threesomes and things like that. And I'm not saying that men are the only ones who do the pressuring or, you know, but I'm just saying if you're a woman in that sort of situation, you may go along with it as a way of pleasing your husband, and you may like some aspects of it, but not like others. But in, you know, you may feel overall that you would rather not do that, but you do it because, you know, and that can be, you know, become a real problem if you're not speaking up for yourself. You know?
Oh, yeah.
If
you're
letting another person define what your sex life should be, for example.
Exactly. And there are plenty of people who are faking their way through their own marriages. I mean, it's very telling when they do these surveys and find out that a lot of women are faking orgasms.
I know.
It blows my mind because it's like, this is your life. If you're not showing up for your own life, what are you going to show up for?
Yeah, you know, I agree with you. You know, it's one of those things that it is shocking to me that you'll have a woman who's been sexually active for 30 years and she says that she's never had an orgasm. And now I suppose there can be some physical reasons for that. I know you're a certified sex educator and sexologist and I'm not, but I've lived long enough and I know enough about these things, you know, just as a person who's lived, most of the time I would guess it's psychological and not, you know, some physical abnormality with her. You know,
but we also have to keep in mind that women's bodies are complex and women have been shamed around them, and men often don't know how to work the equipment.
that's true for a lot of men, but my feeling is, if you take a class
in sex, so you can know how the equipment works, because it doesn't necessarily come natural.
But I think that women have the responsibility, if they've decided to share their life with a man who is in most respects good enough to want to share your life with, but who is kind of clumsy or ill-informed or whatever you want to call it when it comes to pleasing her sexually, I really do think that it's the woman's responsibility to, in a tactful way, you know, to tell the man what she wants. You know,
well,
it's
in my opinion, it's both people's responsibility. I agree. There's lots of women out there who are expecting a man to know how their body works, and they don't even know. They haven't even touched themselves. They've never had a sex toy.
Well, you're right.
They've never gotten a mirror out and seen where all the parts are, and they know nothing about themselves. And yet they expect the man to just miraculously somehow or another know how to navigate this territory that is completely unexplored territory
right.
for themselves. So
but you know,
that is a big problem, mm-hmm. but there's also one other problem which kind of complicates the issue a little bit, and that is that there are some men, not a lot, I personally think that most men are dying to know what a woman wants to have done to them to please them. I know that they'll pay top dollar to learn how to please a woman, and there's not as many women out there trying to figure out how to please a man sexually. But you do still have some guys out there who are, you know, they kind of think of sex as something that's for them, not for her. So.
But when a woman, you mentioned women who fake orgasm, when a woman is faking orgasm, she's really basically encouraging the guy to just go on the way he's doing because he's thinking that he's satisfying her.
Oh, yeah.
You know? How would he know that he's not?
It's an incredibly perverse lie. Because it's as if I went to a store and bought a product that I absolutely hated, that I felt like wasn't worth the money I paid for it, and then went out of my way to make the store clerk think that I loved it. I mean,
right.
That does not serve anyone. The person who's providing me with the service, in this case an orgasm or supposedly sexual pleasure, has no accurate information to base future behavior on, and the person who supposedly is getting an orgasm but isn't is cheating themselves. I think it's one of the most messed up things I've ever heard of.
Absolutely right.
But, you know, I mean, a lot of women listen to Oprah, so I listen to Oprah sometimes to see what the rest of the women are cluing in on. I was shocked and amazed. I mean, here it is 2009, I'm watching this show, and it was like almost all the women, including Oprah, were talking about who hasn't faked an orgasm. And I thought, well, I haven't.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even wrap my brain around it.
Yeah.
It's like, if I haven't had an orgasm, you'll be the first to know. If you happen to be there, if you're on the premises, you'll be the first to know. There's not going to be any secret about it. I will be looking for ways to make sure that I do have one. And maybe that's the big problem there, is women just don't even know how to assert their right to sexual pleasure.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of goes back to the whole, I don't know, grit your teeth and suffer through it for his sake.
And it's, you know, in marriages, it's not just sex, although sex certainly it crystallizes a lot of other aspects of the relationship. You know, in other words, if the sex is really good, chances are that, I'm not saying everything in a marriage is good, but at least there's enough trust there and enough affection there so that the two people at least want to, you know, go get into the same bed together and play with each other's bodies, because in an extreme case, you know, if people are really turned off by each other in a marriage, that's really the last thing they want to do, you know?
It's true.
Which is one of the reasons, you know, why, you know, a lot of times with men, I tend to be fairly tough on men, you know, and a lot of the things that I say and write. I'm not saying that women are perfect by any means, but a lot of guys just, they really don't get it, or they don't realize that there can't be, or there shouldn't be, this disconnect between what happens all day long, and then what happens the minute they crawl into bed together. You know,
oh,
I mean, a lot
I
of guys.
Hold that thought for just a minute, Jim. I'm going to check
sure.
in with our listeners here, and then I actually want to, I have a couple questions I want to ask you about that.
Oh, sure.
For those of you who are listening in or maybe following me on Twitter, I just want to remind you this is a live program. It's Saturday, the 6th of June, and if you've got any questions or comments about divorce, marriage, relationships, sex, whatever's on your mind, feel free to call in. Toll free at 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. Or you can just send me a Twitter. I'm at twitter.com/Veronica Monet. Okay, and our my guest today is Jim Duzak. He's the attorney at Love. He's got really practical, wonderful advice. I can tell this guy really has worked with couples because I've read a lot of relationship books and articles and websites, and I got to tell you, most of them are full of crap. But you're the real deal, Jim. You really are. You've been in the trenches.
Well, thank you.
Dealing with the real issues that come up with couples. And one of the things that I really enjoyed, and I think you were just getting ready to touch upon this, was you were writing about how men need to go out of their way to touch their wives, girlfriends,
in a non-sexual way.
In a non-sexual way, yes. Go ahead and bring that home for us.
Well, you know, so many guys, you know, will spend the whole day or from the minute they get home from work or whatever, you know, they're staring at a computer screen, their wife is talking to them, and they're, if they're answering at all, it's just, and they're not taking their eyes off the computer. And, you know, and then when she wants to tell him something or explain a problem, he's impatient with her and say, hey, didn't you tell me about this last week? You know, I gave you, you know, I told you what you should do, and why are you telling me this again? You know, all that kind of stuff, and it goes on and on and on. And then, you know, at 10 o'clock at night, and then when they, you know, she wants to watch something on TV together, and he just wants to watch the Lakers game or whatever it is, you know, and then they haven't really said 10 words all night long, and then at 10 o'clock, all of a sudden he's horny and he expects her to be, you know?
Yeah.
And he's done absolutely nothing. You know, they talk all the time about foreplay, you know, and if you read the sex manuals and all that, I mean, they have a certain sense of how that's meant and the, you know, but in my mind, foreplay, has to begin the minute you wake up in the morning, really. I mean, because there's all kinds of foreplay that's not discussed in the sex manuals, but really is foreplay. You know, just smiling at the other person once in a while and listening to the other person. And as I say, touching them non-sexually. You know, if I'm with my wife in the kitchen and she's doing something and I'm making, you know, opening up a wine bottle or something, and I'm, you know, if I walk by her, I'll touch her here, touch her there. Again, just a little thing just to acknowledge that I know she's there and that, you know, and I'm paying attention to her even if I'm busy and she's busy, you know, and it doesn't take that much, you know. I mean, a lot of guys think that to be romantic, you know, that they've got to be the second coming of Cary Grant or something, you know what I mean? That they've got to be suave and sophisticated, or that they have to spend all kinds of money and the grand gestures and everything. And
or
really,
Colin Farrell for our younger listeners.
Well, that's right. That's right.
But
really, it just is nothing more than just an attention to the little things, you know. In fact, that's my mantra in life, little things repeated often, you know. And that's really the key to better relationships, you know, rather than the one big extravagant gesture once in a great while followed by nothing. You know,
little things,
you know, I like,
repeated often. You know, the other thing that you're painting here, a picture of, I think women oftentimes feel like, the first picture that you painted was just so revolting and so familiar, unfortunately. I've definitely been in relationships that were like that, where it's like you're with this self-obsessed little boy who thinks the world revolves around him. You bring problems or you want to talk, you want to communicate and connect, and then all the man does is try to fix the problem and then get you out of his way. It's like your concerns are just another problem he has to fix, and it's annoying.
Right.
Yeah, and then it's like, well, but why aren't you sexually aroused now? It's like, you know,
yeah.
What you're suggesting, where you are touching your wife without any sexual connotations, is, you know, I would imagine builds a lot of safety and trust for her, too, where she doesn't flinch every time you touch her because she knows you want something from her.
That's right.
Right.
She's sexually desirable, but not a sex object.
Yeah, you're almost programming her body to relax to your touch.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Know?
You know, and I also like the idea of little but frequent gifts for your wife or the woman that's in your life. In other words, again, the big occasions, certainly you want to honor them. You want to, your anniversary or her birthday, Valentine's Day, Christmas, all those kinds of things. Naturally, you want to, consistent with your means, obviously, you want to get your wife or your girlfriend something, you know, that expresses your love. There's no question about it. But in between those big dates, you know, what you want to do is just to get little things that show that you've been thinking of her. So if you're at the CVS or Walgreens or whatever the, you know, the local convenience store is, if you're there to buy, you know, batteries or something, you know, it take an extra 30 seconds and just, you know, go down the skincare or bubble bath aisle or something. And the thing is, you don't have to, I say this to men all the time, you don't have to be an expert in women's beauty products in order to pick something that has a nice label and it looks nice and smells nice. And you just bring it back, and you bring it home, and you say, and she said, what's this? She said, well, you know, I remember, you know, years ago you used to take bubble baths, and I don't think you've done it in a long time. Wouldn't you, you know, just thought that maybe you'd like to do that again. And the thing may have cost you $4.95 or something, but it's going to go such a long way, you know.
Right.
She's going to be so, you know, she's just going to be so delighted that you were thinking of her. I mean, it's the old line about, you know, it's the thought that counts, and it's really true, that if it shows that you were really thinking of her, and that you got this not just to make up for, you know, to apologize for the stupid thing you did last night or whatever it is, but you really did it just, you know, to make her happy. I mean, that's the best $4.95 you'll ever spend. You know?
And don't you think that goes both ways? I think men also like to know that you're thinking of them. A lot of couples are usually encouraged to even, like, leave each other little love notes around the house.
That's a great idea. Yeah.
Yeah, just so you're not taking your partner for granted. Because let's face it, wives also get into really obnoxious patterns, and it usually has something to do with taking the garbage out and picking up your socks.
Right.
And so pretty soon the man, you know, where the wife may be flinching every time her husband goes to touch her because she thinks, oh, he wants something from me. It's not because he wants to make me feel good, but he wants me to make him feel good. I think at the same time that men often have they flinch, their ears flinch when their wives get ready to speak because they know there's going to be a complaint or an order in there. Like, you
That's
said you were
right.
going to do this. You haven't done that yet. When are you going to do this? You know.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's true. And the guys start thinking, well, you know, this is all I am. I'm just a, you know, I don't exist for any purpose other than just to,
right.
you know, to paint the house or whatever it is, you know. Or
I'm
the,
a paycheck
you know.
And a handyman.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, well, you know, that's the thing. People need to remind each other in little ways that there was a reason that they're living together, that there's a reason that they chose each other, you know, and that their relationship is more than just a household partnership, you know, an efficient
yeah.
system of raising kids, paying bills and all that stuff, you know. It really should be a way to connect and keep on connecting with what's the best in you. You know, and that's why I talk about the authentic life, what's the best in you, and also to try to make that person that you chose as your lifelong partner, hopefully, to make that person help that person live an authentic life too. Because really,
yeah,
the best relationships are when both of you are happy.
this is one thing, another thing that really jumped out for me in your writings is you were talking about a gender difference, that you said 70% of divorce cases are filed by women, and that
that's
husbands
really
are more
thing,
likely
yeah.
to say they never saw the divorce coming. What do you think that's about?
Well, and by the way, those statistics tend to be pretty they pretty much hold true from no matter what state in the country you live in, or because I knew when I practiced law that it kind of hit me at some point that it seemed like the vast majority of my clients were women, and then when I would compare notes with other lawyers, they would say the same thing. And then at some point later on in my career, when I was working as a full-time in-house divorce mediator for a divorce court, a real big, busy divorce court in Phoenix, Arizona, we did an analysis of all the divorce cases over the last 5 years, and it was something like 74.6 or something like that percent of the cases that were filed in the last 5 years were filed by the wives. And I've thought about this a lot over the years, and what I'm convinced of is that I don't think it means that women are necessarily more miserable in their marriage than men. It's just that they're more likely to do something about it. You know, now it may take some women forever, it seems, to do it, and some women won't do it. But when a woman makes up her mind, and this is what I tell men, you better take her complaints seriously, because a woman may just, you know, say the same thing over and over and over again, but at some point, if she feels she's just talking to the wall, there's a good chance that she's going to start mentally making plans to get out of the marriage. And she'll make those plans mentally long before she'll ever see a divorce lawyer. You know, you know what I mean?
Right.
It may be a year or more. And that's what I refer to as sudden divorce syndrome, because during that year, the woman is kind of day in, day out. She's thinking about what her life would be like afterwards, and she's kind of, unhappy at first, but then at some point it starts seeming like something she really wants to do, and she's thinking about, you know, how her life will be better if she gets divorced. And by the time she goes to see a lawyer, and the lawyer files the papers, and the papers are served on the husband, she's got more than one foot out the door. You know what I mean? She's already in her mind in her next life. And the guy, and that's what I mean by sudden divorce syndrome, the guy doesn't see it coming because he hasn't been paying attention to her. You know, he's just assuming that, she's complaining all the time. It's the way she is. You know, she's, she likes to hear herself talk, blah, blah, blah. And,
you had a great quote here. You said, men might say about women, they love, I have something to talk about, even if it's a complaint, but it's no big deal.
Right. It's no big deal until he hears from her lawyer. You know?
Well, it almost seems like this whole pat the woman on her little head thing, there's some kind of patronizing attitude in there, like I'm not taking her seriously because she's always nagging. And
right.
I wonder if there isn't a combination of factors going on there. One thing that women do sometimes get into a habit of nagging, and what I refer to is kind of like the little boy and the mother. Like a lot of marriages are based upon the wife acting as a mother and the husband acting as a little boy. And so she's supposed to kind of keep him in line. And men will even joke about how, she brings out the best in me, or she keeps me in line. And it becomes a big joke, but it's also a really good way to kill one's sex life and watch the marriage go down the tubes, I think. But I think the other flip side of that, you know, where men have some responsibility, is that they may discount what their female partners have to say and unfortunately put it into some of the stereotypical boxes, such as, oh, she's on her period or it must be her hormones.
A lot of guys do believe that. That's right.
Yeah, and not get the seriousness of what's going on here. That, you know, when your woman talks, maybe you need to pay attention.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the toughest part of being a lawyer, or I would assume it's the same if you were a marriage counselor, is that You know, I mentioned how, in the example I was giving, that the wife, you know, may have one foot out the door before her husband even knows that she's thinking about it. You know, there's a theory that there are stages of divorce, in the same way that there are supposedly stages in dealing with serious illness or death. You know, there was that book by that woman, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, some years ago about the various stages of grief and
yes.
death and dying, and the stages of denial, anger, depression, and then finally, you know, culminating with acceptance. And what happens in a lot of marriages or cases they're going to divorce is that the woman or whoever files for divorce reaches the acceptance stage, while the other spouse, let's say the husband, is in the denial or the anger stage, and
right.
so you have two people that are really totally cross purposes there. You know, the guy is saying, "What do you mean? You know, we can still work it out. You know, I'm sorry if you didn't think I was paying attention, but I really, you know, all this stuff." And she's thinking,
"I thought you liked that."
I heard that too long, you know.
I'll bet you, yeah.
Oh yeah, and the thing is, there really is. It's very hard to reconcile those two positions, because once a person makes up their mind, it's very hard to get them to undo it. It's like when a person decides to give their notice at work, you know, and you say, "Oh, gee, you know, we can make it better, and I'll transfer you. I know you had trouble working with that person, and we'll put you in a different department." You know, but once you've made up your mind, those kind of accommodations are just not going to work. You're out of there. You know, and it's the same. It's really true, and it's the same thing. It's the same thing in marriage, and that's the shame. You know, that a lot of times these are things that it wouldn't have taken that much to have resolved those things at the time they came up. But
right.
it's just the accumulation of them over the years has made it impossible.
I couldn't agree more. People need to get more proactive about their relationships. I mean, if in fact they believe it's the most important aspect of their life, in a lot of ways it is, because it feeds back to, you know, your home, hearth, security, health,
I know
mental health certainly, but oftentimes physical health, that you need to take measures to ensure that you've got a healthy relationship now. Don't wait until there's a problem. You know, a lot of people want to wait until there's problems. But you can do something now.
Well, when it sort of comes back to that phrase that I said before about the little things repeated often, it's really true that, you know, that could be used to describe the little preventive things that we do in every aspect of life. For example, if you do 30 minutes of exercise a day, chances are you'll stay in reasonably good shape. You don't have to, you know, go to, you know, some health spa for 2 weeks or something, you know, once
right.
a year. And, you know, just little things that you work into your daily routine can prevent all kinds of problems.
I couldn't agree more. So we're about out of time here, but I want to give you a couple of minutes to tell the folks that are listening about your current services. Now, are you still working as an attorney, or?
Well, I'm still a member of the bar in Massachusetts, and as of the beginning of next year, in 2010, I'll be eligible to be a member of the bar in Arizona, where I live. It's kind of complicated, but I'm not a member of the bar here, because when I moved here, they had a requirement you'd have to take the bar exam, and I didn't feel like doing that after so many years away from law school and everything. But they've changed the rules, and as of January, I'll be able to be a practicing lawyer in Arizona without taking the bar exam. So I'll be looking forward to reopening my law office. But now most of what I do is write. You know, as I say, I've got my book out, Midlife Divorce and a Rebirth of Commitment.
Where can people find that book?
The easiest way is to go on Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com or one of the online booksellers. It's in some bookstores, but on kind of a hit or miss basis. It's easier to do it through the online booksellers.
Okay.
And, There are links, direct links to Amazon and the other ones on my own website, which is www.attorneyatlove.com. And that's attorneyatlove.com. And I also, I guess you could call me a columnist. I write relationship columns for a website called connectionsforwomen.com and also one that's called, a website called boomerliving.com. I write a column called Relationships and the Law there. But I put on workshops mainly here in southern Arizona where I live. On different aspects of marriage, divorce, and also post-divorce dating, which is something you and I haven't talked about here, but it's one of, it's really one of my big interests. I write about, you know, the things you should and shouldn't do with, in terms of online dating, and also just getting back into the dating world after divorce is a big issue for a lot of people, and some people rush in too fast and other people wait way too long, you know. And it's you know, you see women in particular, you know, will oftentimes go 10, 12, 15 years after a divorce before they say, well, now I think I'm ready, you know. And,
well, it sounds like a fascinating topic for another show. I hope we get to do that one.
Well, it would be. I'd love to talk about that sometime.
Well, I'm all for having you back if you want to come back.
Well, I'm here for you, Veronica.
Awesome.
You know,
well, I'll tell you something. I really like your material. I like your attitude. And I especially love the fact that you're not just spouting a bunch of theory or something you read in a book. You've been out there seeing what's really going on in the divorce court. So.
Well, as I say in my book, I've either seen it all, heard it all, or done it all, including making a lot of the mistakes that I try to keep my readers from making.
Well,
so,
I think it's awesome that you're putting such a positive spin on such a negative life event. I applaud you.
Well, it's really true, and you know, I just truly believe that marriage can be such a wonderful thing. It really can be, and I would just hate to see people throw it away for no good reason. You know, I say in the book, I don't so much believe in marriage per se as I believe in good marriages. And if you have one,
and that's
don't
the
let it go.
For us to end the show on. I'm glad you believe in good marriages.
I do.
Jim, we're going to have to sign off, but we'll definitely
it was great,
have
Veronica.
Back soon, okay?
I really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
You're wonderful. Thanks. Take care.
Thanks.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me.
Sering kesepian.